All right, so today we are in Are You Covenanted? Part 37. And we are looking at the idea of covenant and how it relates to Yeshua and redemption through the book of Isaiah. That's where we are right now. We're in the book of Isaiah. We're not going to stay there. We'll probably get through that. We only have a little bit of verses to do there. Of course, we know that sometimes we've only done a few verses in a teaching. Well, you got three verses done. Very good. Okay. So, but I think we'll get out of the book of Isaiah today. We'll get it to Jeremiah and see if we'll get any further than that. But I want us to make sure that what we're looking at here is these are prophetic verses that we know represent Yeshua in a lot of ways. And they also represent the idea of redemption. Because remember, Israel, up to this date still, is in dispersion, suffering the consequences of disobedience. And so we are part of Israel, scriptural Israel, the Israel of Yah. And that Israel is still suffering from the consequences as laid out in places like Deuteronomy 28. Okay, so here we're going to begin in Isaiah chapter 55. Okay, and we're going to begin in verse 1. Oh, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you have no silver, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without silver, without price. Why do you weigh out silver for what is not bread, and your labor for what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me, and eat what is good, and let your being delight itself in fatness. Okay, so let's remember that, like I said the other day, I don't remember if it was during the teaching or during one of the midrashes, is that we have to be careful to understand that sometimes and often when things are being described in prophecy or through any, well, I guess when Yeshua says it, he's the ultimate prophet, they are going to be painting pictures. They're not necessarily literal. So here we're not really talking about food. We're talking about the fact that people would spend their money on things that don't have any value in the actual growth process to go from here to the kingdom. Okay? And that's why, by the way, you labor for things and it doesn't satisfy you. You work hard, you do what you do, or you study hard, and you just find yourself not satisfied. Of course, the good stuff leaves you wanting more, but on some level, you're also satisfied because some of it's coming to being brought into you to satisfy that need to have answers, to have understanding, to have a focus of where you're going, a knowledge of where you're going, and how it all works. He says, listen to me and eat what is good. Okay, now we know when we read through the book of Matthew, somebody said to him, good teacher. How, you know, started off the sentence with good. And he said, well, there's no one good but one. So all things good come through the Father. And so we have to know that he's the one that determines what is good. If you don't understand that whole concept, we did a teaching a long time ago called Well Done, Good and Trustworthy Servant. Part one was to understand what good is. By scriptural definition, because you have the idea of good, trustworthy, and servant. So actually the teaching was, guess what? Three parts, okay? We're going to redo it. Don't even guess how many parts it'll end up, okay? All right, now. So he says, eat what is good. So remember, this is a prophetic section. It's not just a guy who's like a health guru who's trying to tell you to eat better food. He's telling you this to bring into you, to take and put into you, to eat and be satisfied, things that are good. That means they have to come from above. And let your being delight itself in the fatness. Incline your ear, come to me. If you read the Tanakh, actually the Brit's the same way. The New Testament's the same way. But most of you, if you read the Tanakh, you'll see it's always incumbent upon us to make the move. He inspires the move. He will poke you, disturb your peace, cause you to ask, seek, knock, that kind of stuff. But he's expecting you to incline your ear. He'll open it, but you have to now incline it. And now that you have it opened and you're inclining it, he wants you to come to him. We approach him and then he comes to us. But we have to come to him. We come from a background where you think everything comes to us. No, he says, incline your ear and come to me. Hear so that your being lives. And let me make an everlasting covenant with you, the trustworthy kindnesses of David, of King David. Because we understand at this point that Yeshua is the fulfillment of the shadow that was King David, David HaMelech, David the king. So we're going to see in Isaiah, we're going to see this also in other places, we can definitely see it in Ezekiel, that when referring to the coming king, it refers and names him as David. Not that it literally be like a reincarnated David, although a lot of the Jewish communities believe that, that literally King David is coming back. But that's where we see, Yeshua explains this, some of the apostles explain this, you know, it's pointing to Yeshua. Of course, he's of the lineage. And that's the thing, the kings come through David. Now, he says, let me make an everlasting covenant with you. Now, when he says, let me make an everlasting covenant with you, does it mean that there is not the existing already, you know, the original covenant from Exodus 19? Or actually, there's going to be places that we may read, I'm not sure if I took it in or out of the notes or left it there, where it mentions the covenant that was broken, the covenant with Adam, that Adam somehow broke the covenant. The covenant that he's also telling, he says, you guys have broken the covenant all the way back to Adam breaking the covenant. Whoa, whoa, whoa. He knew about the same covenant? Oh, no, Rabbi. Didn't you ever learn there was the Adam covenant and there was the Noah covenant and there was the Abrahamic covenant and they're all different? No, they're not. Now, we have less information about the earlier ones, so we don't have all the details, but they're not different. Yahweh does not change. The expectations are always the same between him and us, human beings. So no, Adam didn't have different expectations than we do. Neither did Noah, neither did Abraham, all the way to Moses. But it's only with Moses because of the number of people that it got codified. Okay? The codification, you know, because people say, well, why didn't they write it down? Well, you know, in the beginning, there was just Adam and his wife and some children. And then with Noah, there was only Noah and his wife and some children and their wives. It wasn't a lot of people that need to write it all down. They could talk about it and have it passed around. Well, when they come out of Egypt, there are about, 2-3 million people, if you kind of extrapolate out the math, because they tell you how many men there were, over 20. And then you got to figure there were younger children, there were women that aren't counted in those numbers. So we guess about 2-3 million people. Well, getting the information to 2-3 million people would be helpful if you wrote it down, if it was codified. And so here he says, I'm going to make an everlasting covenant with you, the trustworthy kindnesses of David. See, I have given him as a witness to the people, a leader and a commander for the people. See, a nation you do not know, you shall call. And a nation who does not know you, run to you. Because of Yahweh, your Elohim, and the set apart one of Israel, for he has adorned you. Now, this is what's going on here. Now, remember, Isaiah is still dealing with them going through the foolishnesses that they've been going through to say, don't do this stuff. But if you would fix it, if you would do the right thing, then the right things would come back the other way. Listen to what he says. Seek Yahweh while he is to be found. Now, you're not going to ever be told to seek and say while, unless that means at some point he won't be. Seek Yahweh while he is to be found. Call on him while he is near. Now, it's not because Yahweh will get lost or you will have misplaced him in some way. He just might not allow himself to be found by you. In other words, seek him while he's open to you seeking him. Did we catch that? Seek him while he is open to your seeking him. He says, call on him while he is near. Okay, so what is the idea of this whole idea of near? When we do, he says, well, first he says, listen, incline your ear and come to me. If we come to him, guess what? He's near. And he's near us when we're in obedience, when we're keeping covenant. And he's distant from us when we sin and we break covenant. Let the wrong forsake his way, verse 7, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Notice that there's a connection there between what you do and what you think. And actually, he's trying to tell you, look, you got to have to forsake your ways, and guess what? It starts with your thoughts. Now, he could have said, forsake your thoughts because it affects your ways. Could have gone either way with that. But I think I like that. He says, you're going to have to stop doing certain things, and it's going to begin by getting your thoughts right. Because remember, you think, and those thoughts, if you dwell on them, eventually end up with, you know, we call it metaphorically in your heart, where emotions get attached to them, and then they eventually, when we focus on them and have enough emotion, they manifest in some sort of action. We call that your ways, what you do, where you're going. Let him return to Yahweh who has compassion on him and to our Elohim, for he pardons much. So this is again a prophet doing what prophets do. They're going to get in your face specifically, listen, this is important. Teachers are different than prophets. Okay, a teacher is going to instruct you in stuff maybe you don't know. The prophet is talking to people that should know. The prophet isn't instructing anything here. He's not giving details about what it is that you need to do or what you're doing wrong, but you should know is what he's saying. You should know what makes you unrighteous or righteous. So prophets speak to those who should know, to cry aloud, spare not, to wake you up and say, excuse me, why aren't you doing what you know you should be doing? And don't you know that if you do it, all this wonderful stuff will come? So they're encouragers from that point of view. They're corrective, but they're also encouragers, which is what I try to do, except people get all mad at me from the correction part. They don't realize I'm also trying to encourage them. But realize the encouragement does come with it. Look, it all started with Cain and Chabal. He says to Cain, if you do well, if you do what's right, won't it be well with you also? Won't I be pleased with you too? Correction, encouragement. But some of you act like Cain. You want to get mad at the other person as if somehow, Cain made himself look bad, not Abel. But instead of looking in the mirror, he wanted to blame someone else. Well, you made me look bad because you did it better than I did it. You did what was right and I didn't. Pointing the finger, transferring the blame. He says, no, all of this here in chapter 55 up to this point is you need to own your stuff. Anybody heard me say that 50 times already? He says, verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares Yahweh. Now, I want you to simplify this idea. It's not that his thoughts are so grandiose that we don't have them. He says, no, my default way of thinking is not your default way of thinking. You don't naturally think like me. You've got this thing called the spirit in man. And it's thick-necked, stiff-necked, stubborn, selfish, me, I, right? He says, neither are your ways my ways. Again, by default, it's not in man to know which way to put his feet even. It says that the way that seems right to a man leads to death. So your ways are not my ways, declares Yahweh. For as heaven is higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than yours. So now he's saying that we have very lowly nothing thoughts and lowly ways. You know, I've been saying a lot of this for a couple of years now. We as a people, especially the men, we need to aim higher. Now, a lot of times I'm talking about it kind of in a life coach point of view about getting your finances fixed and your careers kind of maybe elevated. But really, it's because his stuff is higher. So we need to aim higher. That's where his stuff is. All of us need to aim higher because then that's where his stuff is. Look up. By the way, when you aim, you have to look at the target. So we have to look up, recognize the target, he actually tells us how to hit it. He tells us exactly how to hold the instrument, how to point it, how to shoot, whatever it is that we're doing to aim at a target. But see, we're not aiming high enough because he says, look, you guys are busy with your own thoughts and your own ways. He said, but my ways are up higher. And I'm not talking about literally like up in the heavens, but I mean, they're an elevated, higher standard. Higher behavioral pattern, higher level of treatment of people. And we're still hanging out at this lower level, which is in some ways much more grotesque and not as elegant. I don't know how else to put it. He's got this wonderful, beautiful way of doing things that we have to elevate ourselves to. Again, this is all part of this idea of covenant. For as the rain comes down and the snow from the heavens and do not return there, but water the earth and make it bring forth the bud, bring forth and bud, and give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so is my word that goes forth from my mouth. It does not return to me empty, but shall do what I please and shall certainly accomplish what I sent it for. By the way, your word does the same thing, but is it going in the right direction? You usually end up with what you aim at and what you're speaking about and what you talk about and where you're focused. And so what you say doesn't come back empty either. Except that we don't actually put a lot of thought into what we say. He's absolutely thought everything through on his. He knows the end from the beginning. He knows exactly the ramifications of everything he says. So his word that goes forth from his mouth, does not return to him empty, but shall do what he pleases. That's really important. It's what he pleases. So you see here, he's saying, look, listen to me. Stop spending your time and energy. He metaphors that with buying things. Stop focusing your attention and spending your time and energy on things that are not good. I'm not saying they're bad. They're just not good. Some things are, I don't know how that's maybe clear enough for you guys. There's a lot of neutral things you can spend a lot of time on. They're, in themselves, they're not bad. They're not breaking Torah. But they're not valuable either. They're not going to get you anywhere. He wants you to focus on what is good. That when you take it and eat of it, you become more like him. It takes you further up. We're all looking to elevate to his level, to come into alignment with, to conformity with, to the fullness of. Ephesians 4 talks about that after the fivefold ministry, that we're all supposed to be coming up to the fullness of the character, of the completeness that is of Yeshua, the standard that he sets. We have to elevate to that. Some of us have children, and we've tried to do that with our children. You need to aim higher. You need to think that more things are possible than you can even imagine. We have to elevate our thoughts, and then we'll elevate our ways to him, elevate them to his level. When he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, it doesn't mean you can't have his thoughts. He gives them to us in a book. Isn't that convenient? I'm really thankful for that. When he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, means that without him, you would never come up with them. He has to give them to you. He has to share them with you so we can know what his thoughts are. Let's continue now in chapter 56. We're going to go through 56, and then we're going to be finished with Isaiah. Beginning of verse 1. Thus said Yahweh, guard right ruling and do righteousness, for near is my deliverance to come and my righteousness to be revealed. All right, so stop right there and let's understand. When a prophet speaks, okay, he declares aloud and spares not, he's going to say things like, thus said Yahweh. But you have to be careful. A lot of people out there saying, thus said Yahweh. Ezekiel tells us in Ezekiel 22, be careful because you say, thus said Yahweh, when Yahweh hadn't said. And so we have to be very careful with that. Just want to make sure I'm quoting the right chapter. Yeah, 22, okay? In the 20s, like verse 24, 25 in that range, or 26, something like that, okay? So let's make sure that you are understanding that here is someone anointed and appointed to speak for Yahweh. He says, guard right ruling and do what is right. Well, what's right? Whatever Yahweh says, he determines what is right and what is wrong. For near is my deliverance. So now he's connecting doing what is right with deliverance. If whatever you got going on in your life that you need deliverance from, I'm going to encourage you to try out the plan that Yahweh says, do what's right and deliverance comes. I mean, that's what he said. I've seen it over and over. It works. Anybody felt it worked? Well, then let's keep doing it. He says that my righteousness is to be revealed. By his righteousness being revealed, it's not just him revealing what is right. You're going to see that it actually brings about righteousness. My righteousness will then be revealed in you. Not this Christianese, you know, it's going to be kind of imbued into you. It's just going to be given to you. Yeshua's righteousness is going to be kind of credited to you or something. What did you do to deserve that? Nothing. It's a free gift. No, yes, salvation is a free gift, making it possible that there is an opportunity for redemption. But you've still got to do your part. And so here we have the idea that if you do this, if you are guarding right ruling and doing righteousness, then deliverance is coming and his righteousness may be revealed. I'm going to say it this way. It doesn't say it in the verse. In you. That's the way I'm being inspired to share that with you right now. Okay? That his righteousness might be revealed then in you. Also, what will be revealed is that he was right. Because some of you don't really know that he's right. Some of you are in the process of learning it. Some of you are almost there because it takes experience to recognize that he said it, you tried it, it worked, he's right. Again, he said it, you went and gave it a shot, it worked, you realize, hey, he's right. Some of you tried the other plan. He said it. You weren't sure about it. You did it your way to blow up in your face. And you don't learn from that. You keep doing that model over and over again. That's foolishness. Verse 2. Blessed is the man who does this. Ah. Do you notice that with the Tanakh, you get a lot of blessed or whatever coming connected to doing. Blessed are you if you do them. When the commandments are given, he says, they're wonderful, they're great, and blessed are you if you are found doing them. Well done, you good and trustworthy servant, because you were found doing. Right? So blessed is the man who does this. What's the this? Guarding right ruling, doing righteousness. What's righteousness? Torah observance. Okay? For near is deliverance. And the son of man who lays a hold of it. So it's not just doing it, but you have to lay a hold of it. In other words, you're not just doing it mechanically. You lay a hold, you get it. Anybody remember when you did some of these things, maybe in the beginning, maybe some of you are there right now, you're doing this sort of mechanically because you're just hoping and trusting. And then all of a sudden, on some of these things, the light bulb kind of goes on. And now you've laid a hold of it. When you're new, this happens a lot. When you've been in this a while, it's more, you know, less frequent. It's more, you know, rare that it happens. But there are those moments where you lay a hold of it. It could be when you've heard a teaching for the second or third time, maybe 6 or 8 months later than the first time you heard it, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I get it now. You've laid a hold of it. Now, what's happened in the interim? You've been embracing and doing mechanically. You've been trying to get there, and all of a sudden, now you've been exposed to it in a different mindset from a different place, and your perspective has changed. You're ready to lay a hold of it. So I would encourage you, with the word that you read, as well as with the teachings that I do, because I mean you're my students, that you maybe go back to some of the ones you might have struggled with after a few months and see if they might not sound a little different. I assure you, we didn't change the playing of it. The information is still the same. They're already pre-recorded. You know, they're recorded. We didn't go in there and edit them. But they might sound a little different because you're going to be different, not what I said. Because what I said is going to be the same it was when you got the CD in the first place or when you found it on YouTube. We're not going to change it. Continuing, he says here, blessed is the man who does this and the son of man who lays a hold on it, guarding the Sabbath lest he profane it and guarding his hand from doing any evil. So now we're going to emphasize the Shabbat because, when you read scripture, you're going to find that certain things get emphasized. You know, there are people that will read the New Testament and say, but Yeshua never really mentions anything about keeping the Sabbath. Well, he does. He was in the synagogue, as was his custom, on the Sabbath. But there was no need to talk about Shabbat to the people that were already keeping it. He talked about other things they struggled with, like having their traditions be used to overwhelm or interrupt or get in the way of Torah observance. Or being elevated to equal to. You find that kind of a conversation. You find him addressing hypocrisy. You find him addressing things like, well, you know, of old, it says not to commit adultery, but I'm telling you it's deeper than that. Or not to commit murder, but he's telling you, now they were already understanding the literal part of the law. That's why he gave them more. So for all you out there thinking Yeshua came to do away with the law and make it easier, I think the opposite. I think he made to show you that it's harder than you thought. Not harder, but more challenging because he requires you to understand the point of it, the spirit of it. Not from a charismatic point of view, but from, you know, when we talk about the spirit of something, like the intent of something. Okay, there's the letter of the law. Even in like secular world, they talk about the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, or the intent of the law. That's what Yeshua came to show you, was the spirit of it. When he says, I want to find those that will walk in spirit and truth, think about truth as the mechanical and the spirit, the full intent of it. Take away that whole Christian mindset of some ooey-gooey spirit thing and then truth, which I don't even know what they're connecting that to. I wasn't in there. What do they connect that to? In spirit and truth. The Torah is the truth. Psalm 119, 142, the word is the truth, the Torah is truth. And verse 160 says the same thing more or less. So, and then we know that Yeshua is the truth. Yeshua is the word put on flesh. Yeshua is the walking, talking Torah. Now, that being said, when he says you need to walk in the Torah, walk in the truth, and in the intention of it, that's what we're talking about here now. He says you're going to learn things and you're going to lay a hold of it. When you lay a hold of it, that means now you're getting the intent of it, the fullness of the intention of it. He says, now with the Sabbath, they had Sabbath issues. In Israel and in Judah, as part of them being taken into captivity, they had multiple issues that were Sabbath related. They were personal Sabbath keeping issues, and they were the Shemitah year cycle Sabbath issues. How they treated the land. And that's the one that got them in more trouble than the other one, because they pretty much handled the regular Sabbath, for the most part, without any problems. But what they were really doing is having a problem with keeping the cycle with the land. And that got them in trouble. And you read about that. He says here, guarding the Sabbath lest he profane it. So he said, verse 1, he says, guard right ruling. In verse 2, he says, guarding the Sabbath. I don't know that we can say that enough for us to understand the idea of guarding. The next time somebody calls me and asks me some question about some of these things Torah-wise, that have to do with, well, is it okay to do this or is it okay to do that? I'm going to ask you, which one of them represents guarding? I may just say that to you. Choice A or choice B? Because they'll say, well, do you think it's okay to do this or not? Okay, well, if you do it, would that be guarding? Or if you don't do it, would that be guarding? Because guarding is a whole different level than keeping, observing. It's a higher level. Now you're standing guard over. None shall pass, you know? You got your sword out, and you're going to protect it. But then, you know, are you guarding it when your boss says, if you don't come in on Saturday, you're fired? Or are you guarding your job? What are you standing watch over? Let's be careful. He says, guarding it lest you profane it. So if you work on Shabbat, that's profaning it. And guarding his hand from doing any evil. I've had some of the children ask me, because I guess one of the parents may have said something, well, is it okay to play these video games on Shabbat? And I'm looking at them like, is that guarding it? I mean, it's not work and you're not doing business, but is that really the intent of Shabbat? See, even in the Jewish community, sometimes they get very confused where they focus on what they're not supposed to do more than what they're actively supposed to do. Shabbat has a very active component of focusing on our Creator and each other in that relationship. And you only give him one. You know, he only asks for one day to do that. Okay, he says, take one day and knock off all the other stuff, all the secular stuff, all of the me, and try to focus on me, on him. He said, focus on me. It's not always easy. I mean, I'll tell you how I guard the Shabbat. I'll give you one example. You know, my wife was blessed to be taken to Paris by someone a few years back. And of course, if you know my wife, she took a picture of every part she went to. Well, hundreds of pictures. Back when it was film. Okay, rolls of pictures. And when she came back, it was Shabbat when her sister came by to see her and wanted to see the pictures. And she looked at me, very submissive, very nice, and said, you know, my sister wants to see the pictures. And I said, it's like another 2 hours till the end of Shabbat. Let's just wait. Because I know once you get into it, you're going to forget everything about Yahweh, Torah, and everything else. You're just going to be excited about Paris and the pictures. Okay? Can we all agree that that would happen? Okay. And so she submitted and said to her sister, let's wait. Of course, her sister didn't like this idea because she wasn't guarding Shabbat like we were. She was a Sabbath keeper. She just wasn't guarding it the level that we were. And so you have to ask yourself, are you guarding? Not just keeping or observing, but guarding. Because the covenant requires obedience, but then he expands on it. And throughout, after the covenant, Exodus 19, he almost always refers to guard the commands, guard the commands, guard the commands. Got to guard them. It's not just observing and keeping and understanding them or putting some sort of, you know, half effort into it. You have to guard these things. Okay, some of you are fairly good at guarding your spouses or guarding your children or guarding your valuables. What do you do when you guard something? You have, to do a really good job, you have to have a really high level of awareness of the things that could hurt the thing you're guarding. Correct? So when you own a house, maybe the very first time you had an apartment or had a house or something, all of a sudden you became very concerned with, did I lock the door? Did I turn everything off? Did I close the windows? I mean, there's a different level of concern than it was when it was somebody else's house. And then it was their problem, not yours, right? But now all of a sudden, you're guarding it because it's yours. You've taken ownership of it. Well, he wants you to take ownership. Not ownership where you get to make choices about it, but ownership where you recognize it's yours, it's for you, and you have responsibility for it. So guarding is a whole different level of thing. And I think all of us need to ask the question, am I keeping Torah, am I observing Torah, am I guarding it? Do I embrace it as mine, as having the highest level of value? You know what? We don't guard things that cost $5, $10. Well, we don't guard over them. But when things have the highest level of value to us, whatever that is, we tend to guard, watch over it, protect it. So he's trying to tell you what he gives you in terms of commandments is of the highest value. Because we're going to see as we go through this chapter how he wants to honor people that want to value what he values. So as we continue, he says, the man who takes guarding the Sabbath lest he profane it and guarding his hand from doing any evil. Again, if you're going to bend, twist, or pervert or alter, it's evil. Some of you have this real problem with Torah observance, Shabbat especially. You want to figure out how much you can get away with. Because you want to, not so much of a get away with, I think that's unfair. You want to figure out if there's any way to still do some of the things you still want to do. Is there some way to justify it? Or rational, lie to yourself about it, okay? He says, and let not the son of the foreigner who has joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh has certainly separated me from his people, nor let the eunuch say, look, I am a dry tree. So now he wants to say, he's trying to help people understand that it's not just, by the way, Paul addresses this very much the same way. It's not just about those born in. He says, if you are the son of a foreigner, but you have joined yourself to Yahweh, you're not to think like you're still a foreigner. Don't think of yourself, it frustrates me sometimes when I talk to people who say, well, you know me, I'm a Gentile believer. Let go of the Gentile part. If you're a believer, you're not one of the nations. You're now in the nation of Israel. A believer is an Israelite. By the way, not everybody says I'm a believer is an Israelite, but in the full context of what it means scripturally, to believe in the Elohim of Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, to keep the commandments, to walk in Messiah, you're a believer. You're also Israel. You don't understand that? Listen to the teaching called Discovering Your Identity. Okay? But he's saying is, look, if you are from a background of being a foreigner who has joined yourself to Yahweh like Ruth did, beautiful picture of this. That's why she gets to be in the lineage of Messiah. He says, let them not say, Yahweh has certainly separated me from his people, or say, look, I'm a dry tree. For thus said Yahweh, to the eunuchs who guard my Sabbaths and have chosen what pleases me, anybody of any background who chooses what pleases him, he's going to have a great spot for you. Don't worry what your background was. Don't worry about the abuses you went through. Don't worry about your childhood and all the other awful things. Don't worry about the stupid, bad, and maybe even literally evil things you did. If you have now chosen to do what pleases him, that's what makes all the difference. That's where redemption is, in choosing what pleases him. He says, if you are a eunuch and you guard the Sabbaths, and have chosen, by the way, do you notice that when he mentions commandments, the one that generally comes up only if he's going to pick one out is Shabbat. And what was the first thing that the alternative church did? I'm not talking about the daughters, the main big giant Catholic church, the alternative to what Yeshua had actually laid out there. The first thing they did was change Shabbat. Because Shabbat is, we sing it in the Vishamru. It is the sign between him and his people. It is a covenantal sign. We read that. That's Exodus 31, I believe. Okay? He says, this is a sign between me and my people. That's why it keeps coming up, because the conversation in chapter 56 is about those who are his people and those who are but don't even realize they are because they're feeling insecure in their status. And maybe those who were born in are making them feel insecure. Shame on you. You find that, by the way, if you go to a Messianic Jewish congregation, you know, through the MJAA or UMJC, because after all, being Jewish makes you higher somehow. Nonsense. I felt very bizarre because I went to one of those for a little while with my wife and family in New York, and I felt bizarre because I couldn't believe, like, I looked around the room, it looked like when they were saying some of that very sort of second-class citizen jargon that they say about those that are not Jewish, I felt like I was the only one in the room that it bothered. My wife could tell you that. I looked around and said, why does this bother anybody? And I'm Jewish, and a good third of the congregation probably was, too, in New York. But it didn't seem to bother all the rest of them. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? Why would you accept second-class citizenship? Why would you buy into the Noahide thing, which is designed to keep you as a second-class citizen? To the eunuchs, those that are coming from outside, to the son of the foreigner, if you have joined yourself to Yahweh and you've done what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, there's the wording right there. If you hold fast to my covenant, to them, verse 5, the ones who are doing what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I shall give in my house and within my walls a place and a name better than that of those who are born sons and daughters. Wow. I mean, wow, okay? What, can we embrace that? What do you need to do? Guard the Sabbaths. Guard the right rulings. Guard his righteousness. Do righteousness. It's going to be revealed in you. Guard the Sabbaths. Choose what pleases him and hold fast to his covenant. Exodus 19:5, verses 5 and 6 there. Obeying his voice. Because then he's got a place in his house. In my father's house, there are many rooms. All right, so he's got a place for you. Within his walls, a place for you and a name better than that of sons and daughters. I give them an everlasting name that is not cut off. Because what matters to Yahweh is covenant. Which means that there's a relationship where you trust him, so you do what pleases him, and then it's his good pleasure to take care of you and provide everything, including your joy and happiness, that you could ever want. Amen. But do we understand that? Do we want to embrace that? Do we want to take hold of that and really, truly understand what he's offering you? He says, also the sons of the foreigner who join themselves to Yahweh. So he's talking about the eunuchs, and now he's talking about the sons. And by the way, the eunuchs can often talk about, when he says, I am a dry tree, those that were cut off from Israel. So we're dealing with the lost Israelites, and then he's going to deal with the literal the foreigners, the people that were not born Israel. Okay? Because the eunuchs, he says, to you guys who are eunuchs, you feel like, because one of the prophecies is that you would become like a dry tree, like a eunuch. That the Israel would go and disappear and the lineage would disappear. Because the eunuch is not going to have any babies. Now, it's not that they weren't having any babies. It's just that they lost all of their connectivity. So that a lot of you could be Israel and would never know it. Because that got lost down the line. Some of you do research and will find that, oh, wait a minute. There was great-great-grandma so-and-so or great-great-grandpa so-and-so that used to light Hanukkah candles. Or used to do something on Shabbat or whatever. And you're like, wow. But that's a family where nobody talks about anymore. Shh. You know, he was Jewish. Ew. So he says, also the sons of the foreigner who joined themselves to Yahweh to serve him and to love the authority, the name of Yahweh. It's not like they're just loving the name. Hey, that's a great name. I love it. They love his authority. They love the reputation. They love the family lineage. It represents so much. To be his servants. It's all about serving, joining, serving, loving. To be his servants, all who guard the Sabbath and not profane it, and guess what? And hold fast to my covenant. They hold fast to my covenant. He says, to them I shall bring to my set apart mountain and let them rejoice in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their slaughterings are accepted on my altar, for my house is called the house of prayer for all peoples. How many of you were in church and had that quoted to you lots of times? They forgot to mention the part that this is for the guys in verse 6. The ones who are what? Serving him and guarding the Sabbath and not profaning it and holding fast to the covenant. Oh, I'm sorry, but we're in the new covenant now. Well, then don't quote the house of prayer thing to me. That house of prayer thing was connected to the old covenant. So unless that covenant is the same one being renewed, you're dealing with a whole different set of parameters. See, but that's not what they do. They claim what they want and ignore what they want. So they want to claim that my house is called the house of prayer for all nations, all peoples. Churches claim that all the time. But they lose the context of it. The context is Torah, covenant, in Yahweh. Do what's pleasing in my sight. Guard my commands. Guard the Shabbat. Serve me. Love me. Oh, by the way, that goes back to the Ve'ahavta, Deuteronomy 6, where it says, and you shall love Yahweh with all your heart, mind, strength, being, etc. Goes back to Deuteronomy 10, 12. We are to fear him, walk in his ways, love him, and serve him. It's just being reiterated here by Yeshayahu, by Isaiah. No big difference here. He says, the master Yahweh who gathers the outcasts of Israel. Okay, we're dealing with the eunuchs. And we're dealing with the foreigners. Because remember, there's a lot of intermixing going on. He's going to gather the outcasts of Israel, declares, I gather still others to him besides those who are gathered. So we have here, we have it in Yeshua's day. Especially then after Yeshua dies with Paul and them. Having to deal with the fact that the others. Anybody remember something that Yeshua said that had to do with that? He says, other sheep I have. There are more? Not just the ones that are in the Jewish community that he talked to? He says, other sheep I have that are not of this flock. He says, other sheep I have. Look, we go back to Abraham. Abraham was supposed to be what? He was prophesied to be the father of many goyim, Gentiles, many nations. So the Master Yahweh, who does what? Gathers the outcasts of Israel. By the way, I had an organization we used to work with years ago, and I had to talk to the leader and convince him that it doesn't say anywhere in these scriptures that I've ever read that he, the leader of that group, was going to gather the outcasts of Israel. He had this idea that somehow if he can get enough people, that somehow they would all go to Israel and the Jewish people there would just welcome them in with open arms. Okay, he was a little delusional. I said, look, if they do that, it's only to put you on the front lines. Oh, you guys all want to come here? That's great. Right there, there's the front lines. It's delusional. In other words, you're not seeing reality correctly. It says, the Master Yahweh does the gathering. When we get to Ezekiel 37, and we will, it says, I in every place, and the I is always Yahweh. I will gather them, I will join them, I will bring them back together, I. That's a proper I, because Yahweh's saying it. It's a big problem when you're saying it. It says, the Master Yahweh who gathers the outcasts of Israel declares, I gather still others to him besides those who are gathered to him. Wait, the Master Yahweh who gathers the outcasts, I still gather to him. Who's the him? Maybe it's Yeshua. Yahweh's declaring, I'm going to gather who I gather to him. Awesome. Fantastic stuff. Are we getting this? Is it making sense? Are you ready to stop? I don't want to say that. It's going to be disrespectful. But it feels like sometimes we're playing with it. But I know you're not really playing with it. So I don't want to be disrespectful and say, well, stop playing with it, right? Stop being like, I'm an Israelite, but I'm kind of playing at it. What I want you to do is I want you to take it more seriously. Okay? There's no goofing off when you're on guard duty. Okay, you're not playing with your phone on guard duty. You're not goofing off and just talking to the person next to you on guard duty. You need to be focused because you're on guard duty. Always alert, always aware. Are we ready to stop taking it maybe so lightly is a better way? I don't know. Because remember, this is not an easy transition for you. You came from a place where it was all done already for you. How do you just go from that to taking on all of the responsibility that's yours? That doesn't mean that all of it's yours and he does nothing, but you have to embrace all that is yours. And not just keep pushing off that which you don't like or don't want to do or is inconvenient or whatever. You know, if we're really going to be thinking about end times, which I mean from the point of view that you don't know when your end is coming, you don't know when your end is timing out, then stop playing around, stop goofing off, and get serious. Guard the commands. Embrace. He says, look, those who have chosen what pleases me, verse 4. Stop trying to please yourself, your spouse, your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your kids, or your boss, or your best friend. Let's choose what pleases him. You know, there's a verse in the New Testament that says that we need to come to be the people that have discerned and understand what is well-pleasing in his sight. There's no conflict between the old and the new. They're both saying the exact same thing. Let's go to, we got so much time gone. Okay, let's go to Jeremiah 31. That's the problem when I don't time these out. I have no idea how long I'm going to say about things. I didn't even know I was going to hit the guard thing so hard. But the Ruach, I guess, thought that's what you need to hear. We need to guard the commands. Like in the Rabbi rap. Guard the commands. Guard the commands. If you wish to enter into life, guard the commands. Okay, I can't help myself. Okay. Chapter 31, Jeremiah. Okay, so when you want to understand where people get this whole new covenant thing, all you got to do is remember Jeremiah and the number 31, because 31:31 is where we usually get it from. Okay? So let's go ahead and turn there. In Yirmiyahu, in Jeremiah 31 and verse 31, see, the days are coming. Okay, first of all, context, that means they haven't arrived yet. Now we're going to see as we read through this that they still haven't arrived yet. But at least at the point it was being written, it hadn't arrived yet. See, the days are coming, declares Yahweh. When I shall make, so first of all, we know the context here is that Yahweh is speaking through Jeremiah. But Yahweh is speaking, who is he speaking to? It says, when I shall make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. So why is he going to make a new covenant with Israel and Judah? Because at this point, and still to today, there are two different houses, two different groups. They split back with Jeroboam and Rehoboam in the days after Solomon. And so we have this split. And when Rehoboam went to Jeroboam, was going to go fight to bring them back together, Yahweh said, no, this split is of me. In other words, it serves my purposes, let it play through. Okay. So he says, but there's a day that's coming, declares Yahweh, when I shall make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Mitzrayim. Oh, see, Rabbi, it's different. Well, hold on a second. Let's look at what was different. My covenant, which they broke. Oh, that was the problem. So there's nothing wrong with the covenant. The problem was they broke it. He took them out of Egypt, brought them to Sinai, gave them a covenant, and the covenant is one that they broke. Though I was a husband to them. That's why we claim that the ceremony at Mount Sinai was like a wedding. He said, I was a husband to them. If you understand Jewish weddings, you understand there's a thing called a ketubah. The ketubah is the wedding document or wedding contract. And so our wedding contract is the Torah. In other words, in a wedding contract is laid out the expectations, not the in sickness and health and good times and bad times, blah, 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 that somebody wrote and everybody says. No, they wrote out exactly what they were offering, exactly what they expected, which is what I encourage people to do when I do their weddings. I want you to write out exactly what you're offering and what you expect. Now, you don't have to read that out loud to everybody because some of it's probably very private, but generally, the ketubah should say, we have shared what we expect from each other and we've agreed. Two cannot walk together unless they agree. You have to have an agreement how you walk. And the standard in sickness and health, blah, 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 really doesn't quite cut it. It doesn't really get people emotionally bound to what they're saying because after all, it's not your words. So if you're working with me and I'm going to do your wedding, well, then understand. I'm going to ask, by the way, if you're already married, do it anyway. If you're already married, do this anyway. Go through this exercise. I want you to sit down. Okay, I'm going to give you a little of my premarital or pre-marriage renewal. Some of you guys do marriage renewals. You want to do a renew your vows. Okay, this is what I want you to do. Can all of you that are married if you are married or have been married, raise your hands. Okay, I want to ask all of you a question. When you got married, okay, I'm going to talk to all the men. Did you have an expectation of what a wife looked like? Okay, hands down. All the women, did you have an expectation of what a husband looked like? Okay, hands down. Did the women, did you have an expectation of what you were offering as a wife? What you were offering? You knew what you were offering as a wife. Men, what you were offering as a husband? Okay, once you got married, did it match? You expected what? Okay? Because you get married and you get frustrated with each other and they go, why are you so mad at me? Well, because I expect my wife to do this or I expect my husband to do this and you don't do it. Why do you expect that? I never offered you that. But you're a husband or but you're a wife. We do not have the universal concept the same. What the ladies, and that, by the way, if I took 10 ladies together, they would not all have the same idea of what a wife is. If I put 10 men together, they wouldn't have the same idea of what a wife is. If I took 10 women together, they wouldn't have the same idea of what a husband is or 10 men what a husband is. It's very different. Okay? Both groups do not know all equally across the board what they think a husband or wife is. So what I would encourage you to do, because it's a covenantal thing. Look, when they went to Sinai, Yahweh laid it out. This is what I expect. I'm going to be your husband. I will provide everything. You're going to just obey and trust me. He laid it out. It was very universal and simple. There weren't a lot of nuances and subtleties there. Just do everything I say and trust in me, and I will take care of everything else. Okay? By the way, that might not be a bad idea, men, if you could actually do that. Tell your wives, trust me, and I'll take care of everything. But what I would encourage you to do is this. If you're thinking about getting married, if you're single, you need to have a clear idea, especially if you're already dating towards marriage or something, you need to have a clear idea of what it is you think you're offering. You need to know, this is what you can expect. When I say offering, I mean, when I married my wife, it would have been great if we sat down and said, this is what you can expect from me. This is what I will provide you. And this is what I expect from you. Then she would do the same thing. Then you know what we do? We sit down and we negotiate. Because first of all, what I tell them always to do is when you go to sit down together, nobody's allowed to say, you expect what? You're crazy. Look, there's going to be a couple of items that the other person is going to be like, you're kidding. Those are the items you negotiate. Okay? Because a lot of it you're going to agree on. The stuff you don't agree on, you're going to be like, you expect me to do what? You expect that to be my problem, my issue? You're not going to do this, what I expect you to do? So you start to negotiate from here to here, you come to the middle. And you go, okay, I'll give you some benign examples. Like maybe one of you thinks that you should have date night every week. And the other one thinks once a year on your anniversary, you'd kind of be okay. All right. When a person wants it every night, and every week, and the other one wants it once a year, each one can look at each other like, you what? You don't love me, you only do this once a year. Okay? And the other one's thinking, I'm too busy to do this every week. Whatever it is. It's not that they don't love you. They just have a different perspective. So maybe you negotiate and you do it every other month or once a month or whatever it is that you negotiate. And then you develop the skills that anytime there's something you don't agree on, now you have a way to handle it. You know, who's going to do what? Maybe you come together and both of you are used to paying the bills. Well, who's going to pay the bills? Okay, so figure that out, who pays the bills. And agree to it. Instead of getting married, now you got to figure it all out on the fly while you're doing it. You know, I've known people to get married and they never once talked about children, only to find out one wanted five, the other wanted none. That has happened, okay? That's a big problem. You need to talk about it beforehand, because maybe that's a deal breaker. And now, if it's a deal breaker and you're already married, that's when you come to me and you're miserable because you got married to somebody who has a deal breaker you didn't know about. Well, whose fault is that? Okay? Now, there's the rare chance that the person deceived you. Well, then you want to get out of that one anyway. Okay? But if it's something you just didn't talk about, well, you should have brought it up. What's the expectations? Because you know what, ladies? A lot of you have certain expectations because of things that your father always did or your brother always did, or whatever, you know, that the men did, that you're now going to expect your husband to do. My wife said that to me many times when we first got married. Well, my father always handled that. I said, I'm not your father. Okay? But there was an expectation there. Okay? I mean, some of you have an expectation that if something goes wrong with the car, it needs brakes, it needs change of oil, it needs all those things, that your family always just got under the hood and did all that stuff. I bring it to the shop. My time is more valuable than that. I need to be doing other things. That's not to say your time is invaluable, but that's a valuable thing that you do. I've got things I need to do. I can't sit there and take the time to do those things. Plus, I wasn't raised in a family where my father ever showed me how to do any of those things. Okay, now I can change my oil. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying is I'd rather just let somebody else do it so I could do other things. I'm on the phone counseling with you instead. I'm sure you'd rather me be available for that than being busy changing my oil or changing the brakes or changing something. But the thing is, that's an agreement. Oh, what's that have to do with what we're talking about? Everything has to do with what we're talking about. Because he says here, it was like a husband. He says, though I was a husband to them in verse 32. See, if we're going to be the bride and there's going to be a wedding, we have to understand the roles. He gives us marriages as a way of understanding our relationship with him. How are we going to have a good one with him when we suck at it now? Sorry, being blunt. We're awful at this thing. How do I know? Because 99% of the time I'm counseling, it's because a marriage has a problem. We're just not good at this. And then you wonder why we struggle vertically with our Creator, because we're not good at understanding that level of relationship. Because that level of relationship is the most intimate, most trusting. Oh, but I have trust issues, Rabbi. Well, then it probably affects you with your Creator too. Some of you have father issues because you had awful fathers. How am I supposed to be all, I love my heavenly father and I'm going to do everything. But my father was the scariest, most dangerous person I've ever had in my life. That's a good point. I'm serious. Or maybe you look, Yeshua is our older brother. My older brother raped me, did all these other things to me. How am I supposed to feel about a brother? That he's supposed to keep us safe and look up to our Messiah for peace. It's hard. We've experienced some awful things. And so he's trying to give us that reset. And so a lot of us with our marriages, I would do the same thing. We should be having those discussions. You want to renew your vows? You know each other real well. You should already know what you're offering and what you're expecting. So I love vow renewals because then I can put them under the chuppah and I say, now when you come out of that chuppah, I don't want you calling me all the time because you know what you just agreed to. You know exactly what you're getting. I don't want to ever hear the words, well, if I'd only known. Anybody ever say that when they were married? Well, if I'd have known you were this or I'd have known you were that. A lot of people say that after they get married, early on. If I'd have known. Well, why didn't you know? Because you didn't know how to date. You didn't know how to get to know each other. You didn't know how to do that process. And you know why you didn't know? Because nobody thought that it was important enough to teach you it. And they couldn't do what they don't know either. Who's going to teach you? The people that dysfunctionally raised you? And who didn't know what they were doing? They're going to teach you. That's going to be real good. And some of you are laughing and your parents are in the room. But let's understand, okay? We should have a community. There should be elders. The older ladies to feed into the younger ladies. The older men to feed into the older, younger men. To teach them the wisdom of life in a scriptural, with a scriptural basis. And marriage is a big deal with that because he says, I was a husband to them. Not literally. I was like, and that was the role I played. I mean, after all, he was marrying a whole nation. There's like 3 million people at Sinai. But the role was like a husband. And so I think sometimes that we do, because of the same way we deal with our marriages, I think the same way we also deal with our covenant, which is like a marriage covenant, that we don't understand that we should be really paying attention to what he offers and what he expects. He says it very clearly. Ask the people, this is his proposal. Ask the people if they're willing to do what I say in exchange for me taking them as my special people. That's what he says to Moses. Go ask them. That's my offer. And we read later that that means that they would have no problem with births, they'd have no problem with war, they'd have no problem with strife, their crops would grow without any problem, they'd have plenty of rain, you know, all these things that he promised that they would take care of. They'd have all this abundance if they would agree to obey. Now, the problem that a lot of you had is that nobody told you this growing up. You were in churches that lied to you about it, told you there was no such thing as this. There was no expectation of this. But now you're learning it. You have an informational that's turning into a relational. Right? You're knowing, you're learning, you're gaining knowledge, and now you're starting to apply it. And that's where we're going to figure out, are you actually ready to be married? See, you know what I tell singles? Think of all of you as singles. I don't care if you're married or not. In the context of Yahweh, you're singles trying to decide if you're going to actually be at the wedding feast. You know how you know if you're going to be, if you're single and you don't even have anybody in mind and you're just single and you go, well, what can I do? I'm single. You could become marriageable. Learn how to be what you're supposed to be. You're a man, learn what it means to be the man, to be the provider, to be the husband. Prepare for that so that when Abba is nice enough and generous enough to provide you with the wife, you're ready to do your job. Ladies, same thing. Learn what it means to be a wife. Become marriageable. Be ready to give and offer yourself as a bride and as a wife. Of course, you're going to have to learn these things because you really didn't have, generally speaking, that maybe some of you were blessed enough to have it, but most of us did not have really good examples of what that looks like. And so we just don't know. We haven't seen it. I don't know what that looks like, Rabbi. I've never seen it. Your parents, your aunts, your uncles, your parents' friends, you never saw it. So, and by the way, sometimes you saw what looked good in public, only that you'd finally meet them in private and you see how they were at home and it was completely different. Because some of you are really, yeah, this is where I struggle. If you see me in public, when I'm going and dealing with at home, dealing with the public, whatever it is, I'm the same everywhere. That's not good. I really should be better in public. But still, some people you know, you think, oh, but they had this great marriage. You don't know. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Some people are just good in public. What you need to learn is what the reality is. How do I really be a wife or a husband? And then we can figure this out. And when you understand the role, then when it comes to the context of Yahweh, we understand that he expects us to be, male or female, doesn't matter, the bride. The bride has a role. The submission role, the trust role, the belief and having confidence that you will be taken care of if you trust and obey the groom. That's hard for the men especially, because I'm the man. Well, actually, you know what? It's hard for the women especially, because you guys mostly don't have men that actually do this, do you? Don't say that. Don't rib your husband. Okay? Some of the guys are like, man, don't do that. We got to do this. I mean, the body spends an awful lot of time angry, frustrated, hurt, offended, etc., because we don't treat each other right, because we don't understand the right relationship. And these are covenant relationships. When you got married, you covenanted. If you're going to come into this, guess what you're doing with the Creator? You're covenanting in a sense like a marriage. You're accepting him in the male role, and you are choosing the female role. I'm going to submit, which means that it doesn't matter if I agree or disagree, I'm going to trust, and I'm going to try to do what's well-pleasing. We're going to be helpmates. We're going to figure out what he wants and help him do it. Not that he needs our help. He says he can raise up rocks, but he gives us the opportunity to help what he's doing. So find out how we can help. How can we help? We can take care of the poor. We can treat each other a certain way. We can walk this out and be the light. We're not helping him by knocking on doors and going and bothering people. He wants you to help him by living it and people seeing you live it and being attracted to it. Do you not understand that that's our role? He says, I wanted to put you, Israel, on the hill as the shining light that people would see and say, wow, what's going on there? I think I want that. Whatever that is, that looks good. They've got crops and food and happiness and joyfulness, peace, and nobody bothers them. And this is amazing. How do you have that? What do you do? Oh, well, it has to do with my God, my Creator, and my relationship with him. That's what he wants. You want to help him? Walk it out. That's how you can help him. He wants to have more and more people out there doing his thing, his way, to show people what it looks like. Problem is, you go put your tzitzit on, or you go do whatever you do that declares publicly that you're part of his group, and then people watch you. You are being watched. You know that your family's watching you, don't you? You know your friends are watching you, your coworkers. If you work in a business, in a store, and you made an issue about Shabbat and holy days, they're watching you now. They want to see what kind of talk goes with the rest of that. Because you just made a big deal about Sabbath and holy days and needing to have off. Are you just wanting time off? Or are you really a convicted, sold in, bought in, sold out, whatever the word is, into this covenant thing? Because they want to see what you're claiming, what it looks like. You know, when I get off track and I get some of those anger issues that I have and stuff, my wife is very good to point out, I don't like it when she does it, but it's right, to say, come on, you're the rabbi. You can't be doing that. And I do what all of you would do. I go, what is that? Oh, no, I should say, you're right. I can't be doing that. You are children of the living Elohim. You should be asking yourself when you're doing stuff, is this something I really should be doing? Because you can't be doing that and represent him. Will you represent him? That's why the eight declarations are so important when we did the mikvah. Because you're declaring that you're going to walk out the rest of your life in such a way as to represent him, to give him glory and honor and not shame. Amen? Wow, I barely just got into the first two verses here. Okay, so we'll come back to Jeremiah 31 next time. We're going to go ahead and pray. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Father, we are, wow, we're just so overwhelmed with the realization of how much we don't know and how much we were trained wrong and how badly we could use some really good examples. But we're so blessed that your word gives us instruction and guidance so that we can understand the relationship, that everything that you're doing is about relationship, the relationship with you and how you want our relationship to be with each other. And the framework for that is called covenant. And so, Father, we're just so thankful that with your word, we can dig in. And I'm thankful that I'm thankful that you would give me inspiration for words to share that hopefully will, you know, give people what they need to start to change into that which you have said in your word, so that we can conform to it and mold to what you said in your word, to become the men and women of Yisrael, to as a collective, to become the bride, as a collective, to act in the covenantal role of trusting you as husband to provide all things and protect us. The husband role generally is provide a protector. We understand that. And the wife role is the support, the submission and the trust to show what that looks like. And so, Father, how do we do that? How do we do that when we don't know what we're doing? How do we do that? We have no good examples. Father, we just have to trust you and look to you and ask for your mercy and compassion as you guide us in the transformation process. So at this point, Father, all we can say is thank you. Thank you for not giving up on us. Thank you for calling us in spite of our flaws. Thank you for having the mercy to show us that we can aim higher, and that we can actually be accepted and have a place greater than just sons and daughters. So, Father, we thank you, we praise you, we give you all glory and honor in the name above all names, Yeshua our Messiah. Amen, the Amen. Amen.